Welcome to the Criminal Justice Conversations Podcast, a co-production of Berkeley Law School and the Berkeley School of Journalism. I'm your host, David Onick. Criminal Justice Conversations, recorded in the Berkeley School of Journalism studios, features in-depth interviews with a wide range of criminal justice leaders, law enforcement officials, policymakers, advocates, service providers, academics, and others. The program gets behind the soundbites that far too often dominate the public dialogue about criminal justice to have detailed, nuanced conversations about criminal justice policy. Today's guest is Orange County Superior Court Judge Wendy Lindley. Lindley presides over many of Orange County's innovative collaborative courts. These courts include a drug court, a mental health court, a homeless court, a driving under the influence court, and most recently, a combat veterans court, the first of its kind in California. Judge Lindley was appointed to the Superior Court in 1998. She previously served on the Orange County Municipal Court and as a prosecutor in Mariposa County. Lindley has been honored as Judge of the Year by the Orange County Women Lawyers Association and with the Distinguished Juris Award by California Women Lawyers. She is a graduate of the University of Southern California and Pepperdine University Law School, and she joins us from a University of California Irvine studio this morning. Judge Lindley, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
You started the first combat veterans court in California. Why did you think a court specifically for veterans was needed?
Well, this really arose out of a situation I had in one of my mental health courts where we had a young veteran who'd served several tours of duty in Afghanistan and had significant issues with post-traumatic stress and also traumatic brain injury and substance abuse. And I noticed he really didn't seem to be thriving, and I was very concerned about him. And in the end, he did end up overdosing and dying. And as a result of that, I felt very strongly that we needed to change up what we were doing with these young combat veterans that we were seeing coming back with so many issues to face as they tried to re-enter the community. And so there has been a law on the books for many, many years in the state of California, 1170.9, which did permit alternative treatment of veterans, combat veterans. And so I went with that law to my presiding judge and inquired whether we could do something different with this very unique population and specifically focus on the issues that they brought to the table so that we could prevent this from occurring to other people who bravely served their country. So the presiding judge, Judge Nancy Wiebenstock, was very supportive of this, and we were able to work with the VA and set up an outstanding treatment system. And they even provided us with the very first veterans outreach justice worker in the nation to assist us in navigating the VA and get those services for these very, very deserving participants in the court.
Now, I read that there was one participant who was promoted to phase two of the program, which meant he would have to come before you once a month rather than twice a month. And he protested and said he wanted to keep coming twice a month because he liked it so much. You don't usually see participants asking to come to court more often. What is it about this court that gets that kind of reaction from participants?
Well, you know, everything we do in all of our collaborative justice courts, they're all based on research that's been collected by the National Association of Drug Court Professionals for over 20 years. So everything we do, from the smallest thing to, you know, the largest sort of more global structure that we have in the court, really comes out of that research. So what the research says basically is that human behavior is motivated more by rewards than it is by punishment. So in our courts, we give out gift cards and we clap, which I know sounds somewhat unusual. We recognize people for the good decisions that they make. And I started doing the rewards, probably about maybe 17 years ago. UCLA had been doing a lot of research on methamphetamine, which was a fairly new phenomenon then. And one of the studies they did said that the outcome was that they gave a small amount of money to each client that stayed sober for a week. So I wasn't going to give money to my drug addicts and my drug court, but I went out and bought some coupons just at, you know, various food locations. And the first week that I called everybody's name that was doing a good job, and one person I drew their name and they got the award, our compliance went up from about 40% to 80-90%, and I've actually had 100% days with a, you know, courtroom full of drug addicts. So I know that sounds like a very small thing to give a food coupon award for $5, but the fact is that it does motivate human behavior. And so what we feel in our programs is whatever it takes. And if recognizing people and giving them a small reward assists them in doing what they need to do to grab a better life for themselves, then we're behind that 100%.
Now, you've talked about the importance of rewards, but of course, there are times when people come before you who have a dirty drug test or have some other program infraction, and you are tough on those folks. You don't take their excuses. But what is the appropriate thing to do with someone who slipped back on the road to recovery?
Okay, well, we know that clearly it is difficult to deal with the addiction of drugs and alcohols. Otherwise, our jails and prisons wouldn't be full. So we don't kick people out if they slip, if they make a bad decision. But we do have a swift and immediate consequence for that. And we know the research shows that you're not going to get people well by housing them in jail and prison for a long period of time. But we do use the evidence-based flash incarceration, which means they'll go in jail maybe overnight for a day initially, maybe 2 days. And what that does is it pulls them out of their environment. It's almost like a child. You're giving them quiet time, an opportunity to think about the bad choice they made, why they made that choice, what they can do in the future to not make that choice. But you're not just putting them in jail for a lengthy period of time and washing your hands of them, because that doesn't help anybody. It doesn't help them. It doesn't help criminal justice. And it certainly doesn't help the community.
Now, you've been involved in a number of these courts, as we mentioned, drug court, mental health court, homeless court, as well as the combat veterans court, pretty much from the time you stepped on the bench. What originally attracted you to the ideas of these collaborative courts when you came on board as a new judge?
Well, to tell you the truth, at the end of my first week on the bench on a criminal assignment, I actually drove home crying, because I felt like all of a sudden, coming from a prosecutor's perspective where I had been prosecuting cases of domestic violence, and I really felt so good about the work I did. I felt like I was protecting families, I was protecting children, I was protecting primarily women. And, you know, I went to work every day and felt like my life had meaning because of the work I did. And driving home at the end of that first week as a judge on a criminal calendar, I felt like, wow, you know, look at this. These people are just recycling through this revolving door because of their addiction. And if we look at our criminal justice system, we know that we have more people housed in jails and prisons here in the United States than any other civilized nation on this planet. If housing people in jails and prisons changed behavior, we would have a very low crime rate here. And I'm talking about nonviolent, you know, non-serious types of cases, which are the majority of the people in our jails and prisons. So I felt like I was just part of a big failure. And at that point, I didn't know about drug court. And I didn't know about this other approach. So I started having my clients come back on Friday afternoons, bring in their families, asked them to go to get counseling, tried to give them referrals, just did the best I could to see what I could do about figuring out why did they intersect with criminal justice and what can I as a judge do after their constitutional rights have been protected, after they've pled guilty, to try to get them out of the system so they would never come back again. So that was my effort, and it was a failure. It was a failure because I didn't understand about the seriousness of addiction and the need to have drug testing and have a more formalized approach to it. However, in April of that year, I learned about drug court. I learned about Janet Reno in 1989 starting the first drug court in the state of Florida, where she said, look, folks, here in criminal justice, everybody's in their own silo. You've got the DAs, you've got the prosecutors, you've got the defense lawyers, you've got the probation department, you've got your health treatment program, you got the judge, and nobody's really communicating here. And no wonder the outcomes are so terrible. She said, you folks all need to sit down at the table together and work for a common goal, which is to figure out what this person needs so that they get out of the criminal justice system permanently. And that was the first drug court in the nation. So, of course, I stole every idea I could from her, also from Jeff Tauber, who was the first drug court judge here in the state of California, and tried to implement those as much as I could to create a more of an evidence-based approach to this.
The Center for Court Innovation in New York has pioneered a lot of these collaborative courts, starting with the Midtown Community Court in Manhattan. We had the center's director, Greg Berman, on the show a few episodes back talking about the spread of collaborative courts. Here's what he had to say.
I think that what we're really interested in is spreading a set of ideas that courts can kind of lift their heads up and see the forest for the trees. That we can get better access to information for judges so they can make more informed decisions, that we can create links between courts and social service providers so that we can drastically reduce the use of incarceration, that we can be more thoughtful about measuring the impacts of what courts do on the streets.
How have the ideas Greg just discussed influence your work in Orange County?
Well, I think he concisely expresses the whole purpose for what we do here every day. And the Center for Court Innovation, of course, has been a real leader in the field of collaborative and therapeutic justice. And I think he's right on. I don't think anyone has said it better.
Well, let me ask you then. So you had ideas. You looked to Janet Reno. You looked to other courts in California. You looked to the Center of for Court Innovation. But you had to implement this in Orange County. How did you get buy-in, first of all, from your colleagues on the bench, and then from all the other partners that you need to bring to the table to make this successful?
Oh, boy. I'll tell you, I think the loneliest period of my life was that first year on the bench, because the presiding judge at that time of the municipal court bench where I was not a fan of what I was doing, pulling in those defendants on Friday afternoons and trying to help them change their lives. Even when I learned more and started instituting evidence-based practices, he actually told me that the community didn't support what I was doing, and he and the other judges didn't support what I was doing. And when I was up for re-election, which actually was going to be because I was appointed in someone's seat who had passed away, was going to be within that next year, that they would not be willing to stand up and say that I should remain on the bench. So that was pretty terrifying. But as a single parent with three kids, I had to put some thought in that, and I decided and went back and told him that if in fact the public thought that what I was doing was wrong, then they had a choice and they could remove me from the bench, but that I couldn't see any other way to do my job, and I was going to continue doing it in that way. So, yeah, it was tough. And then another time at a judge's meeting, another judge stood up and he actually pointed his finger at me and said, "You're nothing more than a social worker in a black robe." And I said, "Well, thank you, because at least I'm trying to make a difference here." And it was hard in the beginning because I just didn't know why I saw it this way and others didn't. So like I said, it was very lonely, and there were only a few people that agreed with me. Even defense lawyers didn't. One came to me once with a story that a bunch of them were out playing golf, and they were laughing about me and how I was trying to help these people, and they just didn't think it was going to be effective. But now things are better. Things are much better. We've had some outstanding presiding judges here in Orange County, Judge Nancy Wiebenstock and Judge Fred Horn, and they both really believe in collaborative justice. And that is truly the only reason that we have all these courts here, because it really is in the hands of the judges that administer the courts to allow these courts to proliferate.
Well, after that start, how were you able to convince more of your colleagues to come on board with this approach? What changed?
Well, I'll tell you one thing I did is at one point I was the presiding judge of the municipal court down in South County, and there was a really nice gentleman who was a prosecutor who'd been appointed to the bench. So he was coming to my court. So I called him up and I said, this is what your assignment's going to be, and part of that assignment's going to be drug court. And he said to me, you know, I don't believe in this. And I'm a team player. I'll do what you ask me to, but I want the option to not have to do this if it doesn't go well. I do not believe in this. I said, you know what? Come down, try it. We'll see how it goes. That was, 13 years ago? He still runs a drug court. He loved it. Once you can actually show people, show judges what we can do, and the joy of holding a baby that's been born drug-free, and, you know, the joy of having a parent turn to you and saying, thank you for saving my child, and, you know, returning my child to me, there's... In my opinion, I can't imagine a judge wanting to do anything else. And the majority of the judges who have actually had an opportunity to try this really, really love it. Even most of the judges these days who haven't tried it understand that it saves money, it saves lives, and it's just better for our community as a whole. And so they do seem far more supportive than they were when we tried beginning this many, many years ago.
And you mentioned that public defenders weren't necessarily supportive when you got started. And I know in some other places around the country, this is also the case that public defenders worry about their clients' due process rights. Most of these programs require their clients to plead guilty to get into them, or they also worry about widening the net, that they'll bring people into the criminal justice system who really don't need to be in the criminal justice system at all. There was a quote, though, from a public defender who works in your homeless court, and the quote was, "This is an incredibly intelligent way to deal with a very complex problem." Can you talk about working with public defenders as well as prosecutors and getting both of their buy-in into this program?
Well, you know, in the beginning, I held the very first meetings trying to get everybody to the table in Orange County. And both the public defender's office and the district attorney's office walked away from the table more than once. The public defender's office felt that we were setting up plans to infringe too much on people's, you know, personal liberty and personal choices. And the district attorney's office, of course, thought we were being too liberal and, that we weren't doing what needed to happen, which at that point in time was housing people in jails and prisons to protect society. So it was tough. It was really tough. It took a year before finally we could get everybody to agree to give it a try and just, you know, see how it would go. Today, things are better. I have to tell you, when I sat down with our district attorney and asked him about Veterans Court and told him that I wanted to take violent perpetrators into Veterans Court if, in fact, they had no criminality before they went, after they returned from their military service, they now were engaging in acts of violence. And if those acts of violence were related to their post-traumatic stress, then I wanted to take them. And he said, yes, he did feel that that would make the community safer. So, I mean, we've come so far from when we first started to, you know, open up these courts and try to help people and make our community safer. For the DA now to just jump on board and say, yes, I believe in this, and, you know, this is a good thing.
Now, part of the approach is that you've also created a community courts building in Santa Ana, a one-stop shop that provides wraparound services such as drug treatment and counseling and housing assistance on site at the courthouse. What are the benefits of that approach?
Well, we call it actually one-stop shopping because what we did is we renovated what at one time was an old Buffum's department store building. And the area we have is a dining room. So it's pretty cool because we have a huge wall mural there, which reflects the history and culture of Santa Ana. So we designed this building to be warm and friendly with warm colors. And another gal that works for the court and I put tile up. We call it Santa Barbara cheap because Santa Barbara has a gorgeous courthouse with lots of murals and things, and we wanted it to be different. We wanted it to be a place where people walked in and felt like they could get help and service. And in fact, on the wall where you walk in, it says, "Welcome to your community court," because any citizen is welcome to come in and utilize the services that we offer there. So what we have is we have my courtroom, and in the courtroom, we handle all of the organized calendars that we've discussed, drug court, DUI court. I have 5 mental health calendar courts, combat veterans court, homeless court. And so we handle all of those organized courts within the courtroom. However, outside of the courtroom, we have 23 ancillary services that share office space. So the Department of Voc Rehab is there. Not only do they have an office there, but they also have a computer lab there where they help people learn how to do applications, learn how to work on the computer, and so on. Then social services comes, the VA comes, legal aid comes and provides services that are not of a criminal nature. Who else? We have a medical team that comes once a month and does assessment for psychiatric and medical needs. The healthcare agency is there. Our most valuable partner is the Public Defender's Office. They house a team there of paralegals who are there every single day. And when people come in, they kind of triage, okay, why are you here? What are your needs? If they're for our homeless court, we have 940 clients in our homeless court, and they receive a lot of their services right there in the building. So the public defender's office will link them with services. They'll pull their cases in from other courts so that we can handle them there. We have 23 ancillary services. So it's really nice for me as a judge because I can sit on the bench and say to one of my clients, go out, go the first left, go into Voc Rehab, and sign up. Go out, go in the second left, go to VA services and get, you know, find out what your benefits are and sign up for the help that you need. So it's just really, really great.
And I don't think that can be underestimated for folks who are homeless, for folks who have serious drug addictions, for folks who are struggling in other ways, to make it so easy for them to walk out of your courtroom and immediately access these services without having to go across town and wait in some line somewhere at some other agency.
Yeah, I think I can explain it this way a little bit better. If somebody is schizophrenic and a judge says to them, all right, you need to go here and you need to do this. You need to go see this doctor. Then you need to go get your meds. Well, if you are actively schizophrenic and maybe you're paranoid and you get on the bus and you think the bus driver is going to hurt you, you're going to get off the bus and you're not going to go where the judge told you to go. So in traditional court, that, you know, a warrant probably goes out for you and you get some jail time and, you know, nothing's working. It's just such a huge benefit to be able to say, walk straight down to the end of the hall. Healthcare services is waiting for you right there. It changes everything.
Now, what research has been done on the effectiveness of Orange County's collaborative courts? Do we have evidence that they are indeed making us safer?
Okay, here's what we know at this point. We have, for our drug courts, we've had 1,401 graduates. And this is in the past 16 years, 76% of them have not recidivated. So these are all felony drug addicts. And that is an incredible statistic, because if you look at what would have happened had they gone to state prison, which they all would have, they would have recidivated within 18 months, 75% of them, I believe. And then if you look at DUI court, it's one of the most amazing ones. 779 graduates, 95% of them have not recidivated. In the mental health courts, 151 graduates, 78% of them have not recidivated. And combat veterans court, we've been open 3.5 years. We have 23 grads, and we have no recidivism at this point. So, yes, the recidivism rates definitely show that this is far more successful than other treatment modalities and approaches. But we can also say is that we save a ton of money. if you just look at drug courts and the savings from housing in jails and prisons, there are several different studies out there, but one says $7 for every $1 spent. I think another one is $3.50 for every $1 spent, and another one is higher. It's $10. But that's just for these drug court clients. If you look at the mental health court clients, the savings are far greater because it is extraordinarily expensive to house people in hospitals for mental illness, and those clients tend to recycle through the hospitals and jails at a far higher level than others. As you're aware, our jails and prisons in the United States are our largest mental institutions, which is wrong. You know, if we look at society by how we judge, how we treat our most vulnerable, we have truly failed with the mentally ill. And we've got to change up what we do with these human beings who are suffering. So if they were diabetic, we'd be handing them insulin and exercise programs and doing everything we could. They're mentally ill, and we're locking them up. And we got to change that.
On the issue of cost effectiveness, you make a strong argument for the cost savings of these programs. But those cost savings usually don't come to the court, right? They're savings in incarceration costs, in crime on the streets, in other things. And courts right now are facing severe budget cuts, as you well know. In fact, next week is Law Day, and the theme is going to be no justice, no courts, no justice, no freedom. And people are going to be speaking out about the severe budget cuts to our state courts here in California. How have and other courts like yours have had trouble maintaining their funding in this budget environment? How have you been able to keep these courts going, given the budget crisis that courts are under right now?
Well, there is a benefit to the courts, and the benefit to the courts is that these folks, first of all, get out of criminal justice. So that's helpful in the long run. But the other thing is we're not issuing these warrants all the time. And every time we issue a warrant, it takes a lot of time and energy for the court staff and all the paperwork and so on. So there is a benefit to the courts. It's not huge as it is to the community at large, but there is a benefit. As to maintaining these courts in these tough economic times, the court never does get any money for doing this work. So the money goes to probation, it goes to the treatment end of it, but it doesn't go to the courts and it doesn't go to the lawyers. So it really just needs to be a decision that this is something valuable for the community that needs to be kept going. I do believe that our court administrators believe that having the 940 homeless court clients and these other clients who are heavy users, the mentally ill clients, heavy users of regular court justice does free up the judges to do the other kind of work that needs to be done on behalf of the court. So there's no big money savings here, but there is a savings in terms of efficiency and better outcomes.
Sure. And for Veterans Court, you saw a population that was not getting its specific needs met through any of the other courts and decided to start a new court, a Veterans Court. Are there any remaining populations that you think would benefit from a specific court that don't have one now?
You know, it's interesting you say that. I was just contacted this week by a gentleman who's interested in looking at issues of gambling because they are, you know, that's something that is treatable. But my greatest interest would be to have a court for the caretakers of elderly people, because we're seeing more and more of that now, of abuses, financial and physical, of older people who are being taken care of by family members. And that's a big concern I have. And I think it would be really appropriate to set up a system whereby those cases could be monitored, because in the end, they're going to have contact with their family members again. And I hate to see them once again vulnerable without the issues of substance abuse and mental illness being treated on the part of those who abuse the elderly.
We just have time for one more question. I'd like to ask, going out, what advice do you have for other jurisdictions who might be listening to this and say, wow, that sounds fantastic. I would really like to start something like this in my county. What would your advice be to those folks? How do they get started?
My advice would be to start with law enforcement. Once law enforcement understands what you're doing, they really get behind it. I actually had officers that write in their police reports, this looks like a good candidate for, you know, for drug court. We often used to have law enforcement officers come to our graduations because it was very gratifying for them to see that what happened at their end in the field resulted in this really good outcome. And I have to tell you, my clients were more excited to have their police officer there seeing them now totally changed than they were to have almost anybody else at their graduation. So getting law enforcement involved is essential, in my opinion, because these, you know, are there issues on the street. And if you're standing side by side with law enforcement, I think people are going to listen to you. So I would definitely do my best in that area. And, of course, then you just have to go agency to agency and get buy-off. And, you know, in this day of economic stress and issues, to me, this makes sense. What doesn't make sense is the failed experiment of jails and prisons. If we truly want to have better bang for our buck, we should be putting our bucks in collaborative justice programs.
Well, that's a great note to end on. Judge Wendley Lindley, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Please tune in next time when we'll be joined by Amy Bach, author of Ordinary Injustice, How America Holds Court. Thank you for listening to the Criminal Justice Conversations podcast. You can find this episode of the program and all prior episodes on our website at www.law.berkeley.edu/CJConversations. on NPR affiliate KLW's website, and on iTunes. You can also become a fan of Criminal Justice Conversations on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at CJ Conversations. Our production assistant is Nicole Jones. I'm David Onick. Thanks for listening.